I'm Bill Teeple. This is Alan Cobb to my right and Donna Colby to my left. And we're in the Icon Gallery on the square in Fairfield. And this is Icon Art Radio.
And I have to apologize in advance as the producer of these audio programs for not placing Donna on your left and myself on your right, because the show is pretty much coming out in monophonic sound.
It's all right.
Probably good. No one would have known that if all right. You hadn't just said that.
Yes. Before we proceed, let's quickly tell the audience again that we can now hear our radio shows on the Icon Art website.
Yes, you can go to icon-art.org and click on the picture of Donna and Bill and myself, and that will take you to a page with a list of all of our Icon Art Radio shows since the second show. The first one seems to have slipped into oblivion. But there's about 65 of them, and all you have to do is scroll to the one you want to listen to and click on it anywhere on the title of the show, and it'll start playing almost instantly. And if you decide you want to save it for posterity, which we would be most flattered to know, then right-click on it, or I guess on a Mac you option-click it or something like that, and it will give you a choice of a few things you can do with it, one of which is to download it. So you can download these as MP3 files and save them on your MP3 player or on your computer and listen to them whenever you want.
So today's subject is the audience and the role that the audience plays in this communication process and the activity of the artist, because the artist has a relationship with his object that he's created, or his play, or his piece of music that he creates quietly in his studio. And it has its effect on the universe just through its existence and through this process that's taken place. However, when we take the statue from the Holy of Holies and we parade it through the streets for the masses to enjoy, each individual aligning the street brings to the experience of the goddess or the god his own reality structure. And then there's the reality structure of the group. And this is, there's a tension and a dialogue that takes place between the artist's reality structure and cognition of reality, which is often the artist is often given a special status because he seems to have some insight into reality that maybe the others don't have or yet to have. And so when the artist's object is brought into the ritual space for enjoyment, there's this dynamic and tension that's created, and a working out and an enlightening experience that results from what reality structure each individual brings, what the group's agreed upon reality, and the cognition of the artist. It all creates a dynamic that we believe here at Icon advances evolution. What do you think about all of this?
Well, the audience is an interesting component in the process of being creative. I mean, whether it's in coming up with a good business idea or painting a good painting or writing a poem or anything else, you know, you want the audience to exist and you want the audience to like what you do, but you don't want the audience to be mere flatterers, and so you want an honest response that is positive and favorable. And at the same time, it's very tempting to pander to that response in some way and to, you know, tailor your work so that the audience likes it more, or you know, confine your work to things the audience has already liked until someday they say, would you please stop doing those blue ones? But there's a period of time when people are saying, would you do more of those blue ones? And of course, the best work comes from, you know, when you're going deep inside. So thinking about the audience isn't really entirely to the point, depending upon what it is you're doing. So that, there's an interesting, you know, set of energies and tensions in those relationships. And of course, just on the audience side of the coin, you've got a person thinking, gee, I really like that, but I know all of my friends won't like it. So I'm not sure if I like it as much, knowing that my friends don't like it. Or I've never even seen it before, but my friends said it was horrible, so now when I'm looking at it, I'm thinking there must be something horrible about that, or my friends wouldn't have told me it was horrible. And so the audience has a kind of creative challenge to view something with an open mind in the hopes that the work of art has something to offer that might not be immediately obvious.
Well, and there's a fine line in the interaction between the artist and the audience, too, between the artist pandering to the audience and mainly being focused on pleasing the audience and listening respectfully to the audience's opinion.
Yeah.
Because that can be a very healthy thing, you know, and the artist can then be sparked in some new way or see some, actually gain an insight into his or her own work that wasn't there when he was just working in the studio. But it's a very delicate balance to do that, listen to the audience without going in that further direction of just catering to the audience.
Yeah. I guess in the case of a painting, it's easier for me to imagine painting it entirely for my own exploratory reasons, whereas writing something that I want someone else to read, and they're going to really have to put some time and energy into it if they're ever going to read it. Where in the writing process, I'm thinking probably more often from the beginning of how am I going to be able to communicate something successfully to someone else. Mm. Whereas I might be happy to make a sound composition that nobody but myself would necessarily ever want to listen to.
Well, and in the context of a painting too, a person can stand there and look at the entire painting instantly.
Yes.
Whereas if it's a book you've written, you not only have to, you not only want to communicate clearly with the person, but you have to engage their attention for 500 pages or however long the book is.
And
so it's a whole different process because you want them to gain the complete view of the whole work, which takes a long time.
But still you have to take the audience into account, unless you're just not going to show it. It doesn't matter at all. You're not thinking of the audience, you're just thinking about the beauty of form.
Yes.
But if you're thinking of its effect on an audience, I mean, well, you actually do have to, I think, consider the effect on the audience and the language that the audience is bringing to it, even if it's a painting. The forms, you're communicating to them through forms that they will recognize or they won't recognize. And so if I want to communicate an idea to a French person, if I'm just speaking English and he's just watching my mouth move and sounds happen, there's no communication taking. So I have to take into account the fact that it's a French person, I should be speaking French to him. And it actually applies more than just language, it applies to the forms that you're using and the ability of the audience to look. I mean, we have become accustomed to being able to look at abstract painting today, non-representational abstraction, and people can enjoy it as a musical composition of visual form. if the first time anybody ever presented that, he had to deal with the barrier of no one being able to look at it because it didn't look like art or anything that where communication could take place. So you basically had to teach the language a little bit to the audience in order to have the communication.
Yeah, and that's a regional thing too. It's like certain languages of art become well known in a place like New York before they become well known in a place like Iowa, you know. And if you're, like for you, Bill, running a gallery here in the middle of Iowa, you have to, what your audience wants who comes to see these shows is they want to learn something new. They want to be exposed to something new and cutting edge and be expanded by the art, but at the same time, they don't want it to be so foreign to them that they just don't get it at all. Because then they come in and see the show and feel this completely disconnected and puzzled by it. So for you as a curator, it's a tricky thing, I think, to give them.
It's the fine line we're discussing here. It's without pandering to the audience, you have to take into account what they're bringing to the table.
Mm-hmm. I guess you're looking at what the audience can appreciate rather than dwelling on what you think they will appreciate.
Or should appreciate.
Worse yet. It's quite relevant to me at the moment because I'm working on a seminar and workshop series on finding your voice. And of course, the only reason to find your voice, or the main reason to find your voice, would be to communicate. And we have this notion of communication as being the transmission of a lump of content from one person to another. But I think there's something much subtler going on in the realm of communication that isn't understood. We don't do justice to it if we think of it as transmission of a signal from A to B. And it comes across, I think, a good example of it that I've been playing with for the workshop is simply to take a piece of excellent writing and read it word by word without much in the way of inflection or timing or anything. And you are, you know, technically speaking, communicating the content.
Reading out loud.
You're reading it out loud, yeah. And yet if you read it out loud in such a way that your reading, the art of the reader begins to bring out the content that's being read. Obviously, you know, you can read something in a very boring way and you can read something in a very lively, communicative way, and the latter does justice to what the writer was trying to accomplish and the former doesn't. So that whole domain of what the writer was trying to accomplish, that's another thing being communicated that isn't the words at all.
It's an interesting point because I just became aware, I hadn't known this before, that they give Grammy Awards to people who read their books on tape. And they just announced yesterday that Barack Obama just won the Grammy this year for reading his book on tape, beating out Bill Clinton's most recent book, and I can't remember who the other person was that he beat out. Bill Clinton, of course, had won it on another year, as so did Hillary Clinton, win the Grammy another year for reading her book out loud. But I thought that was a fascinating thing that they give a Grammy for.
Yeah, that's very
readers.
Well, and very fascinating that those particular people are getting awards for reading their books.
Yeah.
It's certainly true. If you write something and then read it out loud to someone else or even just to an empty room, if your writing has holes in it, when you read it out loud, those and you hear yourself speaking those holes, you'll realize that this isn't complete. I've left something out, or it doesn't even make sense. And similarly, I believe that if you're a writer and you want to get better at writing really well, then you need to read the writings of people who write really well out loud.
Right. Yeah.
Because when you read them out loud, you as you read, you look ahead, and you take in the next phrase or sentence, and you very quickly process that and figure out what it means and what he's trying to get across and how to express it, and then you speak the words. So you have actually become the author in a very tiny way, 10,000 times in the process of reading the thing out loud.
Well, and the other thing you were saying earlier about it isn't just communicating content, what people don't often realize with the best writers is that the sound quality of the words, which consonants they chose and the sounds of the vowels and the rhythm of the vowels and all that is a big part of the skill of writing.
Yeah.
And when you're reading something out loud, that comes across on some level, even if the audience isn't specifically noticing what
right.
tricks the author used in that context, they're feeling a certain way and getting into a certain mood based on those particular sounds.
Right.
You know, because if you choose certain consonants, you choose words like zippy and jazzy and buzzy and stuff like that, it feels completely different than if you're using words that are more flowing and soft.
Yes, sonorous and mellifluous.
Right. It just.
So this is interesting because it brings up that writing, that a book is not just word. It's not just a bunch of words. Mm-hmm. That actually what's getting generated in the atmosphere is a living, speaking being.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't happen, then it hasn't created the wholeness that it's supposed
yeah.
to.
Well, in the great user manual for the human mind written by Patanjali some thousands of years ago, known as the Yoga Sutras, he defines verbal communication as the fluctuation of consciousness that arises in the awareness of the listener. He doesn't define verbal communication as the transmission of a unit of information from A to B. He just talks about B. It's the result as the verbal communication, and that's what's worth putting the attention on. And that means if you're communicating, your attention needs to be on the listener. And, you know, if you're an actor or a poet or a writer or a speaker or a preacher or a presenter or a teacher or practically anyone whose lips aren't glued shut, you really need to be listening to the audience as you speak.
And also, as a listener, what you realize from, you know, that whole definition of communication is how you can listen and learn in any context, no matter who is speaking. It's like,
right.
I know when I'm in a certain mental mood and very receptive mood, every little phrase I hear on the radio or over here on the street, whether it's by children or a commercial even, can give me an insight into something.
Mm-hmm.
And I can, you know, something of life is communicated to me by that.
Yeah.
So what this is bringing up is that there's only one
absolutely.
Reality,
mm-hmm.
and that
absolutely it's simply movement of knowledge within the field of knowledge.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we're sort of like this duality thing is just a way to enjoy what it is. So
mm-hmm.
At any moment, the receiver mm-hmm. is capable of cognizing the entire reality.
Yeah, and the receiver is creating the result. The speaker is not.
Exactly.
And so the receiving party, that's why the transmission receiving, you know, concept is so wrong or so inappropriate. Obviously there's something there, because if they speak English and the other person only speaks French, then there won't be much communicated. But there may be quite a bit communicated.
It just
won't be.
A wink of the eye could do it.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Yeah. In fact,
sidelong glance.
My son Dane, when he first went to Italy, when he was like a sophomore in college, and he had been very shy with the girls before that point. very creative person, but kind of a quiet guy. And when he went to Italy, the Italian girls were very fascinated by him because he had these great big round blue eyes with really long eyelashes, and he was kind of a gentle soul, and they were very attracted to him. But he had no ability to speak this Italian, and they didn't know English, and he felt far more comfortable socializing with those girls than he did with American girls, mm-hmm. because he was able to communicate in his own quirky, creative way without relying on his verbal skills. And he had his first real girlfriend, and he had girls fighting over him in Italy, and they couldn't speak a word of the same language. It was really an interesting thing for him.
I remember riding on it was on the roof of the cabin of a small Greek fishing boat as we crossed the Aegean to visit an island with Maharishi and some other people. The Greek government had been offering the island to the TM movement to start a school or something. And it was kind of crowded in the cabin, and I'd climbed up onto the roof to sit next to the boatman who was piloting us over there. And it was this sort of funky old fishing boat, you know, with peeling paint and a thumping, funky little one-cylinder engine somewhere in it. And we're plonking our way across the Aegean. And I'm sitting up there in the sun and the breeze, you know, just admiring the view. Next to this real gnarly old Greek fisherman. And I spoke not a word of Greek. I mean, maybe one or two words. I could say tikanis, which means how are you, and kala, which means fine. That was about it. And I'm sitting there next to him thinking, God, I wish I could communicate with this guy. I bet he's got all sorts of interesting things to say. All of a sudden, he tugged on my sleeve and he pointed. And over to the right, you could see the bottom of the, you know, the ocean bottom going by, and this incredible turquoise water that's just unique to Greece. You've got to be in the Aegean to even believe it. And I looked over, and there wasn't anything there. It was just especially beautiful. And I smiled, and he smiled, and we kind of like, you know, nudged each other, and we had shared this moment. Well, for the next hour, we did that over and over again. Mm-hmm. Something interesting would catch one of us, and we'd point it out, and that's all we needed to do. And it was that same thing of not speaking, you know. And after a while, you realize people who are speaking aren't saying much beside that anyway. They're saying, hey, look, we're both seeing this. Isn't that wonderful?
That's beautiful. That's a beautiful story. And it points out, I think, the importance of traveling to places outside of your own culture, because we kind of get locked into a certain way of communicating with people we always see. And it reminds us, when you have experiences like that, how the desire for human connection transcends, you know, locality and groups and all of that. We really want to, like you, the first thing you said was you were sitting up there with this Greek man and you wanted to communicate with him.
Yeah.
And somehow you found a way
to
do that. And I think we all do that whenever we're traveling in foreign countries, and it's a boundary breaking thing, really very heart
fulfilling. Yeah, it was wonderful. Thing. And he would, you know, he would say something every now and then. He'd say something in Greek, and I would laugh, you know, and say, I have no idea what you just said. And he would laugh and say something in Greek that probably meant, I have no idea what you just said. And then we laughed at that. You know, we knew that we couldn't communicate verbally, so we were making do.
But there was a distinct communication.
There was tons of communication going on.
Yeah, and some, like, there was this Vietnamese woman in Paris that ran a vegetable market that I would go to every day when I was living there, and she liked me a lot for some reason, you know. And every time I would go in, she spoke French, and I spoke hardly any French, just a little bit, and she didn't speak any English, and I, of course, spoke no Vietnamese. And so I would go in there, and she wanted so badly to communicate with me and connect with me that she would say things like, "The Beatles." Something that gave, you know, and I'd say, "Yes, yes, you know, yes, the Beatles," you know, or she would name some author or something that she'd find some way to connect. And then one day, she put my vegetables in a bag, and when I got home and unpacked the vegetables, I discovered in the bottom of the bag that there were two heart-shaped rocks that she had put into the bag. And so what I did in response to that was made a little watercolor painting of the two heart-shaped rocks and gave that to her when I went in next time. And then the next time I went in the store, she had framed the little watercolor painting of the heart-shaped rocks and put it on the wall. Right. So it was this incredible form of continual communication that got deeper as time went on.
And it was all positive. It was all on the basis of giving.
Yeah.
Giving or sharing. You know, I'm not sure if there's a difference, but I guess sharing is like mutual, simultaneous giving. Mm-hmm. But it's a very basic thing.
So there's, what I'm hearing here is that in terms of what the audience brings to the communications, the artwork is, that there's a there's a agreed upon sort of way of seeing things that the group has, and that's very much around words and treaties and agreements. Mm-hmm. And then there's a kind of universal connection that just on the level of all being human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that I think we're all attempting to get at that level of connection. And this traveling that you brought up is a way to get around that. And mm-hmm. I found that to be true in my life, that to expose yourself to as many different ways of seeing things and to see various different groups. It's like going through different, the different colors of glass. And in the last 20 years, in my experience has been because I've nomaded a lot.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.